This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
I'm interviewing Dr. Jane Greaves, who's visiting Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics, but works at the University of St Andrews. So welcome to, I think, possibly your third ever Jodcast interview.
Oh, exciting. Thank you.
So the previous one, it's a few years ago now, but it was a national astronomy meeting, and you were talking about a survey called Pebbles, which was actually very appropriately named because it seemed to be essentially kind of looking for pebbles
in space.
So could you tell us maybe a little recap of it and then how it's been going over the last few months and years?
Well, the idea of Pebbles, which stands for Planet Earth Building Blocks, the Legacy eMerlin survey, so it does indeed spell pebbles, is to look for pebbles in space, or more specifically, small bits of rock orbiting young stars. And these are the raw ingredients out of which planets form. And they're very hard things to detect. You can imagine even finding a planet around another star is really difficult. So how are you going to find a few little rocks? But they actually give off quite a lot of radiation, and more like heat radiation at long wavelengths than what we think of normally as light we can see. So they get off millimeter waves and radio waves particularly, and that's a very distinct thing that other kinds of emission don't really produce, that kind of spectral signature. So we planned this survey, which is the longest wavelength this has ever been tried, using eMerlin, run by Jodrell Banks, to look for these raw ingredients of planet formation.
So when you're looking for the pebbles, do you need to have a whole sort of field of pebbles, a whole debris field? I mean, presumably you couldn't just pick up one. Is it just picking up the kind of the whole population of them, and how do you know that they're that sort of size?
Well, we're looking for tiny bits of rock are sticking together into bigger bodies, basically, because that's how we think planets form. So the natural place to look is the material orbiting around very young stars. And eventually that should all turn into planets, which orbit much like the planets in the solar system. But these early stages, this raw material, this kind of grit, if you like, is just spread out like a big plate of particles moving around. And that's why they're very strong emitters, because there's actually quite a lot of particles. They emit well wavelengths about their own size. So if you go out to the radio and you observe at a wavelength of about 5 centimetres, like pebbles is going to do, basically you can see fist-sized rocks by this method.
Wow. And are you able to see what they're made of? Because it's quite exciting. You're really seeing the outer and inner parts of a planet before it's even stuck together. So can you get an idea of what materials are in there?
Absolutely, yes. That's what we're trying to do. Because this is very difficult to do, we're not going to get too much of an idea from these exact observations of what the planets are made of. There are other ways of looking, for example, spectral signature of water lines in some of these, what they're called, circumstellar disks, these plates of stuff orbiting around young stars. So facilities like the ALMA millimeter telescopes down in Chile can do that kind of science, and it can also be done with space telescopes. So the radio is really more telling you just how much rocks there is, and that's a very important thing, because you know if you want to make an Earth-like planet, you need the mass of the Earth, which is 6 × 10²⁴ kilograms, some very big number like that, to be glued together. So if you find a lot of stars don't have that mass of rocks, then the chances of ever making an Earth seem nil, really.
So a gas giant, I suppose this is kind of an obvious question, really, but that wouldn't involve pebbles, as in sort of granular-sized or sort of grit-sized bits of rock, then presumably that's just sort of a big cloud, is it?
It starts very much in the same process. So either a lot of these grit-sized bits can come together till you have something with enough gravity, kind of an enormous super comet of rock and ice fluff will collapse under its own gravity and make a planet core. And then in the case of Jupiter, that happened early enough, was massive enough, that the gravity of that body could attract a lot of the gas that was still orbiting the star at that point. The other way of looking at this is there's a really massive disk. A part of it can just spontaneously be a bit denser than the surroundings and sort of collapse in on itself. So that's the way we think that some planets very distant from their stars might be made.
So I don't know if this is a question that's able to be answered at the moment, but if you were looking at the Earth as an alien or something and you found all these materials that were on it, like an abundance of oxygen and carbon and nitrogen and things like that, do you think that would be a very unusual sort of mix, or is it the sort of thing that you might expect to find elsewhere out there commonly around other stars? And I suppose water as well.
I think the mix is probably pretty similar everywhere, at least sort of in our part of the galaxy, because these are cosmic elements. They're made in stars. So stars don't one day decide to put out gold instead of carbon or something. So the ingredients are there. It's the details of the process that are so fascinating, because we know of one habitable Earth at the right distance from its sun for liquid water and atmosphere that survives and things, and that's us, obviously. One of the things we hope to do with pebbles in a very basic way is look at some of these young stars. Because of the fine detail that the E-Merlin array can see, we can actually look around these stars and separate the sort of distances where Earth and Mars would form from those where Jupiter and Saturn would form. So it's really the first clue at very early times when these stars are incredibly young of if just any of the right stuff is there where we might want to make terrestrial planets like the Earth and Mars.
That almost answered my next question, actually, which is why is E-Merlin so good for doing this? So you're talking about an array that lets you peer very closely into these systems.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, well, E-Merlin, I think a lot of people don't realise it's an array of telescopes spread over quite a lot of England and Wales. So the furthest apart, I think, are about 200 kilometres. And that's what enables us to see these very fine details. And that facility doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. I mean, people may be more familiar with American or Australian arrays of telescopes, but they're actually not as big. So this is the one in the world that we've been given a chance to use, and we're just starting to get our data, so it's really exciting.
Fantastic. And when these planets eventually condense, I probably shouldn't call them planets, when they become planets from their collection of grains, what sort of time scale does that happen on? Presumably we can't hope to watch it happening kind of in our lifetimes.
No, I think that's a bit unlikely unless you're planning to live rather a long time. But well, the second theory that I mentioned, the one about spontaneous collapse, means that the stuff to make the planet, it certainly wouldn't be completed, but it would have kind of come together in one orbit of that cloud of gas and particles moving around the star. So we're probably still talking about hundreds of years. We wouldn't really see it in our lifetimes actually fall in to make a planet. But by looking at lots of these objects at different times, we're hoping to find different behaviours. And if we're very lucky to catch some planets, protoplanets we'd probably call them, we can get a kind of clue by putting them together as a set as how the whole thing happens. So it's very exciting.
And when they get bigger, do they start to get hotter? Do they then move away from the sort of regime that E-Merlin looks at? To shorter wavelengths?
They will, yes. So some of the future infrared space facilities are really exciting for this because the collapse of the body kind of traps the energy and then it can't get out very easily, so it kind of heats up inside. Not as much as a star, but it does make a sort of glowing hot spot. So then you want to move to shorter wavelengths which match hotter objects better. So first the ALMA, the millimetre array I mentioned, and then more the far infrared stuff that we're hoping to do with space interferometers in the future.
Ah, okay. So you'd actually have elements of an array that were up in space.
Yes, there are plans for this. I mean, obviously the technology is very difficult, but in maybe a decade or two, we'd be able to launch some things like, you know, slightly smaller versions of the Hubble Space Telescope, but linked together, just stationed in space, keeping the same distance from each other, that works basically the way the E-Merlin array does on the ground, with a lot of impressive technology even more behind it.
That would be fantastic. Well, it's interesting. I find one of the most interesting things about it is that you might imagine, without going into detail, that the way that planets form is understood. But it's actually, even though we stand on a planet right now, we don't know exactly how different sorts of planets form, do we? And I think it is interesting as well that you're also working on a body. I won't call it a planet because technically it's not in our own solar system, which is Pluto, almost in our backyard, really. So what have you been finding out about Pluto?
I've always been fascinated by Pluto. I think even as a child, by the fact it was found by a kid they hired from a farm to go through a lot of data because he was so enthusiastic. And astronomy is really like that. Anybody can discover something important. But Pluto as a dwarf planet is kind of part of what happens in between and how successful you are in planet formation. Do you just end up with a lump of rock or something the size of a dwarf planet, about 1,000 kilometres or so in radius? Or do you end up with a fully blown planet? So if we can understand why these dwarf planets are there, that's also a sort of side clue. So what we've been doing is we looked at some data at millimetre wavelengths, which had actually been lying dusty in the archive of the James Clerk Maxwell telescope. And I vaguely remembered these data had been taken way back in 1997.
Wow.
And nobody had ever really looked at them. And because I was really keen on Pluto, I was thinking, this would make a great project for a student. So my student 2 or 3 years back, Ailsa Whitelaw, who's a now graduated and a bachelor's student from the University of St Andrews, did these as her project. And I didn't know what it would be like. It was really open-ended. But what she actually put together was the first ever millimetre light curve of Pluto. So a light curve is what we see when we can't make an image, a picture of something, but it's rotating. So you can tell if it's got dark and light sides, for example. So you can make a very crude map of where these dark and light patches are on the surface. So the Hubble Space Telescope, for example, has been doing this for Pluto, but it had never been done at these very long invisible wavelengths, invisible to the eye. And what in fact I also found is that it doesn't look like the optical one.
So you mean the dark and light patches don't line up with where the
visible and this was a real surprise. Certainly wasn't new science I was expecting to come out of someone's student project, which should be for their degree a more sort of low-risk enterprise. But no, she found this great result we've just submitted for publication. And the thinking is that these long wavelengths can actually come out in what you might call the soil of Pluto, a bit further down. It's not really a soil because it's not like farmed, but, you know, it's crumbly rock and ice and so on. So the visible light we see is really just reflected from, say, ice patches on the surface. But this long wavelength light is coming from deeper down, so it can potentially tell you that the surface is different underneath. So if you ever wanted to go and mine for methane and its frozen form on Pluto, for example, you'd know that you might not want to go where there's a tiny thin layer on the surface, but actually there isn't any underneath.
Oh, I see. Okay, so you're actually probing what materials are just there under the surface of Pluto.
That's right, yes.
And because there's a mission on the way there now, and Pluto seems to be getting cool again after being demoted, it now seems to be very fashionable again. When New Horizons, the mission, goes there, will this information that you've got help to inform them a little bit when they make their observations?
I hope it will, yes. In fact, there's a student-built instrument on the New Horizons mission, so it's a nice link to having a student work out some of the ground-based data. It does a very quick flyby of the dwarf planet in July the 14th, 2015, so it's just under a year from now. It's an exciting year of run-up. But the flyby itself, because the New Horizons spacecraft had to be launched to get there so rapidly, it can't stop. So the flyby, when it's really taking detailed pictures of the surface, is like half an hour or something. Yeah. So that actually means that when it's very close, it can only see one side. It kind of flies over one hemisphere. And the most interesting part we saw below the surface is on the other hemisphere, which is kind of slightly annoying. But it does mean that as New Horizons continues, as it flies away, the hidden side comes into view a little bit. So we may get some more clues there. Particularly as, in fact, there's a radio instrument on New Horizons. It's quite a simple thing. It's not as sophisticated as the visible light cameras, but we're really hoping to get an even deeper picture of what's going on in this mysterious hemisphere.
Yeah, I am looking forward to that when that probe flies past. And what materials do you find yourself looking at with the data that you had?
There's a lot of frozen ices that are not common things we have on the Earth. So some of it is normal, like water ice, but it's incredibly cold there. It's only about 40 degrees above absolute zero. So other things turn into ice as well. I mentioned methane. There's also carbon monoxide, which would be toxic to us as a gas, and a lot of nitrogen particularly. So it's kind of an icy world, but very different from, say, polar ice that we're used to.
And then as our last question, when New Horizons shoots off into the outer parts of the solar system, what sort of things are you hoping it will observe or find? Because it's not exactly clear what it's going to see, is it?
No, because this is a very unknown region of space that's so far out on the outskirts of our solar system. I know they're trying with the Hubble Space Telescope, for example, to find another dwarf planet that it could visit without too much course change. So it'll be kind of find them along the way and hope for the best. But this whole region, the Kuiper Belt object of things as small as comets and up to the size of dwarf planets, is very badly explored. One of the things is even to find the small particles, the grit we were talking about at the beginning of the interview, that's still orbiting out there. And the student-built experiment I mentioned, the student dust counter on New Horizons, which was built by a team of undergraduates in the States, is actually doing some of the exploration because it's looking for particles, little bits of grit that hit the spacecraft on its way out. Hopefully not big enough in the next year to cause damage, but also telling us about what this primordial stuff is like, how much there is, where it is, and so on.
So it's sort of largely unchanged from the very early days of the solar system, is it?
That's the idea, yes. So we still don't really know how these dwarf planets are stuck together and how many there are and why a lot of them are different to each other. Some are very icy, some are very rocky. Pluto's the only one we know of so far with its own very thin atmosphere, so it's all a big mystery.
Excellent. Well, those two things fit together quite well then, the sort of studies of the outer parts of our own solar system and then the primordial accretion disks around other stars.
That's, exactly.
It's very exciting.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for the interview.
Thank you.